really. Firstly, I'm older than I look. Okay, who wants a guess as to how old I am? That's my wife, she can't guess. I'm 47. Jeez. So I know. My father has a baby face too. And I've spent approximately 20 years in medical practice, a significant portion of that as a clinical assistant in Hayward House Hospice. So I spent many years working with the terminally ill. And God has more recently called me into the ministry, and I've spent the past 9 years studying theology, including ethics. So if you take those two things and put them together, I would hope that I'm reasonably well placed to give you some idea about how to think about something like assisted dying. Okay, so if you think that's a good enough reason to stay and listen, then make yourselves comfortable. Why this topic now? Well, on the 11th of September, there's something called the Maris Bill, which is coming before Parliament. And that bill has this headline: to enable competent adults who are terminally ill to choose to be provided with medically supervised assistance to end their own life. So that's what Parliament will be voting on the 11th of September. And so now is a really important time to think about this. I just want to be clear about my overall approach this evening. I am a minister. This is a church. This is not a debate this evening. This is a lecture. So I'm giving you my considered opinion, and I will do my best to present both sides of the argument about the nature of assisted dying, and in particular about the Christian response to it. That's my purpose for this evening. Okay, I'm not going to argue for the existence of God. I'm not going to argue for the existence of the Christian God. And I'm not going to argue for whether Christian ethics is a good thing or not. I'm assuming that all those things are good things. That's my starting point. Okay, so I hope you understand and accept that. This is an overtly Christian argument this evening. Because what I want to know, and what I want to help you know, is what is an appropriate Christian response to the Maris Bill. All right? So that's the point of this evening. Just to give you an idea of the world we live in and how it thinks, current public opinion is that 82% of the British population support a change in the law to allow doctors to help patients to die. Currently, as of 2014, so that's actually not this lot of MPs, but the last lot, 30% of MPs support such a change in the law, and 40% are undecided. On the right of the screen, that's actually a very similar-looking set of figures from Australia. About 83% are in favour of a change there. So you can see that in Western-like countries, this is the kind of thinking that is prevalent. I need to start off with some definitions so you're clear about what we're talking about. Assisted dying can be a couple of things. There's something called euthanasia, which is commonly known as mercy killing. Euthanasia is the deliberate killing of another non-threatening, innocent person whose life has been deemed not worth living. All right? And that can be in three forms. It can be voluntary, so that the person is asking for it. And the Maris Bill kind of touches on that. It can be non-voluntary, such that the person is no longer competent, but on the basis of what they would have wished for, then you make the decision for them. Or thirdly, it could be involuntary, where euthanasia is performed against somebody's wishes, and history has some examples of that. Secondly, assisted dying also includes assisted suicide. Suicide is deliberate self-killing. And physician-assisted suicide means that the doctor provides the means for the patient to kill themselves. And this is primarily what the Maris Bill is promoting. Next slide. Now, this is a deeply serious issue. Death is, if you like, the final exit from this world. I'm not a legal expert, but I think it is important to just pause and be clear about what the current legal position is. Intentionally hastening death, is that murder or isn't it? Well, this quote from Cairn states, "It has always been murder for a doctor actively and intentionally to hasten a patient's death. nor is it a defence to plead that terminating the patient's life was a reasonable and proportionate way of securing a higher good, so-called defence of necessity. So if you intentionally hasten somebody's death, legally, it's murder. Next slide, please. Just to be clear on that, somebody called Lord Gough said, if you kill from the motive of compassion, so-called mercy killing, I nevertheless intend to kill you, and the crime is one of murder. So it's serious stuff. Current thinking amongst the population has been probably affected by the right to refuse treatment. Some people might therefore think that, well, if you can refuse treatment, that's not so far from actually going one step further and actively taking treatment to end your life. But it remains a fact that suicide, although it's not criminal, is unlawful. Assisting somebody to commit suicide is criminal. So that's the current legal position. Okay? Legal and cultural change is happening throughout the world. Some countries are at the forefront of that. Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, and the American state of Oregon are the ones in the headlines. They have changed the law to make assisted dying legal. What's driving this? Well, technological change has meant that the process of dying has become longer and much more technically complicated. There's lots of machines involved sometimes these days. So this process of dying and the change of it has led to people thinking differently about death. Institutional change, where hospitals are under pressure to become cost-effective, and where I think in the medical profession there's been a tendency to think of death as something that happens when treatment fails. So this type of institutional change has driven thinking. And thirdly, cultural change, such that autonomy, the idea of the autonomous individual, has become much more prominent in modern history than it ever was in history before. And it's led to a rights culture where people often think in terms of this is my right or that is my right, such that in the modern state, people might think that they have a right to kill themselves. Whereas actually, as we've already seen, it's not legal to do that. Okay. So that's the definitions of what we're dealing with. The other thing I'd like to just offer you are the main ethical theories by which people can approach this sensitive issue. As with any other area of human thought, if you have a pile of data and you approach it with a theory, it depends which theory you take to that data as to the outcome you get. If you have a different ethical theory and you approach the same problem, then the different theory will give you a different solution. So we have to be very mindful of this and very careful about what theory we're using. There are three, I would suggest, three main theories that are relevant for this. Some big words, but I will explain them to you. The first one is deontological. Okay, that's the traditional Christian approach where there is an objective moral truth. There's such a thing as absolute good and absolute bad. And under that idea of deontology, killing is generally thought of as prohibited, that killing somebody is a bad thing. So that's deontological ethics. The second area is something called consequentialist ethics, which started, I think, in the 1700s from economics. You can blame UCL, because Jeremy Bentham started consequentialists. It's much more relativistic, and they might take sort of two paths and say, okay, from the same situation we can take two paths, what's the outcome of those two paths, and which of those two paths would lead to greater human happiness in economic terms? And that has become a very common way of doing ethics today. In fact, in my experience in medical practice, I would say that the ethics taught in medical schools and practiced mostly in the health service is consequentialist ethics. Ideas of autonomy, ideas of first do no harm, do good. And autonomy and the freedom to choose and the rights that come with that is very prominent in consequentialist ethics. But, and here's a big but, in consequentialism, there is no such thing as an inherently good or an inherently bad act. The only thing that's important is the outcome, and that might affect how we approach this. The third area is something called virtue ethics. Now, I would suggest that if you look at the New Testament and the emphasis on character development and character formation and Christian virtue, that actually the idea of virtue ethics is probably a very good one for a Christian to consider. Virtue ethics would ask the question, what does this act do to my character or to the character of society around me? So those are the three main areas. In terms of the question before us, is there a Christian case for assisted suicide or assisted dying? If euthanasia might be the answer, then what's the actual questions? I would suggest that in order to be able to give an answer to this, we need to ask two major questions. The first one is, can human life lose its value? Is it possible for human life to lose its value so that you no longer think it's worth living? And secondly, is it ever permissible to end the life or to kill an innocent person? So those are the two things that you have to answer to be able to decide that it's okay to end a life. Is the life worth anything anymore? Can you kill an innocent person? And I will be approaching this specifically from a Christian perspective. Taking the first question first, can human life lose its value? Within that, I would suggest might be three questions. Firstly, if it's valuable, then what do you do with that valuable life? What is a responsible life? Good question to ask. How do you live responsibly if human life is valuable? Secondly, in that life, if suffering happens, how do we view suffering? And thirdly, when might bodily life be deemed valueless? Okay. So looking at the first question, the question of responsible life. It's Christian orthodoxy that life is viewed as a gift from God. Now, some people who are wanting to think about assisted dying might ask the question, well, if it's a gift, if God is giving us this gift of life, and I will do my best just to say, to try and present both sides of the argument here, okay? One argument might be, if you're given a gift, then the donor might, if it's genuinely a gift and given to you, relinquish rights to that gift, so it's now yours. So you can do what you like with that gift, the gift of life. Well, somebody else might say, well, surely you have to show some degree of gratitude for the gift. But if the gift becomes unsatisfactory, might there be limits to that gratitude? That's one argument that's made. Secondly, well, if it's a gift, can it be more of a sort of loan so that when you're no longer able to care for that gift, if you are incapacitated to the point of not being able to live a responsible life, you might return the loan and end your life? That's the kind of argument that is sometimes made to promote assisted dying. And they're good arguments. However, if you consider it in terms of virtues, I think the virtue of gratitude is key to understanding this. If human life is as precious as we think it is, then from sheer preciousness alone, it's a bit like handling a masterpiece. You don't really have limits to the gratitude, and you don't really say, well, I'll only be grateful up to this point. Because of the sheer preciousness of the gift, then gratitude is never-ending. And in any case, why should you measure life in terms of crude satisfaction? Whether you are satisfied with your life or not does not alter the preciousness of the concept of life. There is something beyond crude satisfaction, and the Christian view, the Orthodox Christian view, is that you're able to bear witness to goodness and truth. Whether you're satisfied with your life or not, you're still able to bear witness to life. Secondly, Christian orthodoxy would state that there's a vocation and a responsibility that comes with living. We are servants of the Creator. Those that would want to argue for assisted dying might make the point, well, if we're servants and we're no longer able to serve, if our life has deteriorated to the point where we can't function, then are we obliged to stay in our positions? Might we end our lives and make room for somebody else to be a more capable servant? That's one argument that's used, and it's a reasonable argument. I would say this in reply, that actually each one of us, each one of you, is irreplaceable. We are unique. And there is an individual, unique vocation for each one of you from God. And so this idea that you might end your servanthood and make room for somebody else doesn't quite work, because there's nobody else that can be you in the whole of history. Okay? You still with me? So we're still thinking about responsible life. Life is a gift, and we have a vocation. Can life lose its value? What if we do have a vocation, and it becomes such that we become so ill that we are no longer able to fulfill that vocation? That is vulnerable to a utilitarian ethic. That means that if you measure things in terms of how useful they are, we might become unuseful. It's impossible, perhaps, to do good. Is that a possibility, that we simply can't do good anymore? If that's the case, then how specifically might that happen? How might life specifically lose its value? And following on from that, what might the forms of life look like that we're not obliged to sustain, if that's the case? Now, in making that last statement, I'm not saying that if you're not obliged to sustain the life, that actually that's tantamount to saying it's okay to kill. What I am saying is that we might be able to let some people die. Okay, so following on this idea of responsible life, there's a very helpful distinction that somebody called Rachel has made between biological existence and biographical existence. Biological existence is brute existence. Something exists. Biographical existence means that you participate in a story of life, in life's narrative, such that you have a story to tell. And that doesn't end until your life ends. Rachel says this. I need my reading glasses. There is a deep difference between having a life and merely being alive. Being alive in the biological sense is relatively unimportant. One's life, by contrast, is immensely important. It is the sum of one's aspirations, decisions, and human relationships. The point of the rule against killing is the protection of lives. So there's a distinction between brute existence, where something is merely alive, and biographical existence, where you're joining in with life somehow. So let's explore this a little bit more. With an extreme example that might help illustrate the case. There is something called persistent vegetative state. You might have heard of it. It's in the news from time to time. Persistent vegetative state is where, and that's an MRI scan of the brain of somebody with persistent vegetative state. Somebody in this state is a human life. All the reflex activities are going on, so the human person is breathing, the heart's beating, but there is, if you like, nobody at home. There is no higher cerebral brain function. They are merely biologically alive. That is brute existence. So that you could say that that is human life, because in a sense it is. But is there a person present? Merely biologically alive is not the same as saying there is a person present who can participate in life. There's a qualitative difference to do with autonomy and biography. I want to explore those last two points. This is a famous chap, Jack Kevorkian, in North America. He made a big thing of autonomy, which, if you remember, is from consequentialist ethics. The patient's autonomy always, always should be respected, even if it is absolutely contrary. The decision is contrary to best medical advice and what the physician wants. Next slide, please. So this idea of autonomy, I'm going to go out on a limb here. This is what I feel. Autonomy comes from consequentialist ethics, largely, and it's become an unconditional value in our modern society, such that autonomy is king, that people have free to choose independently what they feel is right and wrong. And under those circumstances, it gives moral permission to people to choose to end their lives because it's their life, so why wouldn't they have the right to choose? Within that is the idea of somebody might deem their life to have become subnormal in some way, less than normal. And within that also is the idea of autonomous self-evaluation, that it is the person themselves that decides whether their life has become subnormal or not. That can lead to something called moral relativism, where you might decide one thing, I might decide another, there might be completely different things, and yet they'd both be true. That's a direct consequence of autonomy. And we have to be very careful about this, because it is then possible to get very different ethical answers from the same situation. So that's autonomy. Moving on to biography. If a life is different to brute existence, then there is something about living that life that creates something. You create a story. So the creative enterprise is part of what's sacred about life. Just as God creates, so we can participate in that creation. And that sanctity of life is in part about creative enterprise. If somebody's life deteriorates through illness or disability such that there's a reduction of participation in that, well, somebody can still retain the capacity to shape, even though they become quite disintegrated as a person. If somebody becomes particularly incapacitated physically, or perhaps begins to lose their memory, suffering with dementia, though their participation in life is reduced, they still shape life for themselves and others at a very basic level, but it still happens. Can personal existence disintegrate to the point where there's irrevocable frustration such that you cannot at all shape life around you? And that's something to consider. Okay? Are you with me? Well, can that happen? What's important to consider here is the difference between personhood and personality. Personality is a phenomenon. You experience the phenomenon of my personality in all its variety. My wife chuckling. There's a person behind that. And it's the person that participates in life, it's the person that shapes life around them. Now, with any ethical theory, a good test is to go for difficult cases or ambiguous cases to try and figure out, well, how can we work this out? And the question really is there a person present? Is there a subject present? Because if we have a gift of life from God, and that gift is at least in part to have a vocation, we do something good with our lives, then that requires a response. So to respond, you have to have a person present. Let's think of some extreme circumstances. And I think there are three categories here. A person could be hidden, such as in a locked-in syndrome, such as if you have motor neurone disease, and the disease leads to the point where actually you have difficulty communicating, even though the person is in there. You can find ways round it. The person can be found and can communicate, albeit with difficulty. There is a person present. So therefore, there's the capacity for responsible life and vocation. Difficult though it is, it's still present. Think of Stephen Hawking. He's kind of locked in, really, but he has a profound effect of the world around him. And today, his software, I understand, has been made available to everybody if you need it to speak. The second category is that idea of a dormant person. For example, if somebody has a very traumatic brain injury and ends up in a coma, the coma could be reversible, so the person is dormant and could reappear at some point in the future. So in these ambiguous cases, there's still a person present, whether they're hidden or dormant. That person is at home. They've not left their home. And therefore, that affects the idea we view the biological existence. There's still potential biography there. There's still potential story there. There is a third category that's very rare, and it's one I've mentioned already, this idea of permanent vegetative state, where there is nobody at home. The heart's beating, the lungs are breathing, but there is no person present in terms of there's no higher cerebral function, and there is permanent incapacity to communicate and shape life around you. I want to suggest that I think that third category is different to the others, such that there is, you could go far as to say that there is no personhood, there's no human personhood present. Okay? So it's important to think about that. So, my conclusion on this little bit, my suggestion to you, is that this idea of biological and biographical distinction has some usefulness, brute existence versus ability to shape life, and could be acceptable as a way of ethical reasoning about this area. That then raises the question, how tightly do you define this biographical life? And this is where it really rubber hits the road. And those that advocate assisted dying make a lot of subjective self-evaluation, where the person themselves decide whether they've got a useful life or not, and autonomy. I'm going to have a look at both those things with you now. I would like to think about this idea of self-estimation. It's not that surprising in our society because autonomy is so prevalent, but what it effectively is if you decide for yourself whether your life is worthwhile or not, then this is an exercise in absolute autonomy. You have no moral compass, you're not locating or adjusting your norms to anybody else's, you're just deciding for yourself. It's an absolutely private morality. And that means that anything goes, which is, I think, a dangerous ethical road to walk. Secondly, if we return to the idea of humans with vocation, humans with purpose, with a God-given purpose, then you have to go beyond an absolutely private morality to have any meaningful vocation. Because you need a cosmic context to have a vocation in. You need to have a world bigger than you, with an ethical world bigger than your ethical world. It's necessary for vocation. Otherwise, your world becomes one little goldfish bowl. And thirdly, and this is not very popular these days, but I think it's a very important point that society would do well to focus on. If you have a human life and are part of society, you have a duty and responsibility to others around you. And especially for a Christian, I would go as far as saying that our life is not our own. There is a communal aspect to our life, and our life actually, in a very real sense, still belongs to God. So I would criticize this idea of self-estimation and the ability to decide for yourself what's the best end of your life. Next slide, please. I would also like to challenge the idea that autonomy is king. It's very, very prevalent in any doctor's surgery. You go in there and it's all about the patient's wishes, isn't it? Autonomy leads to this idea of an active, ideal life where you contribute in a utilitarian way. Whereas, if you lose autonomy and you become dependent in some way, dependence can still be a responsible, fulfilling life. It might be a passive form of life, but it's still responsible. It's more receptive, it's more appreciative of others, but it's still a responsible life. And that's over against this idea of an active, autonomous, ideal life that society tends to promote. This chap called Nigel Bigger, he's the professor of moral and pastoral theology at Christ Church, Oxford. He's a very clear thinker on this. He says this: we are still responsible subjects even when we are not asserting ourselves, when we're not in control, helpless, when life is less something we have than something that happens to us. We are still responsible subjects. There's a chap called Hans Reinders who's written a book called The Gift of Friendship. It's a beautiful book, and it looks at the theology of disability. And actually, even when life is very, very passive, such that you have maybe never have had or have lost the capacity to do certain things, there is always the gift of friendship. You can give and receive love at a very basic level sometimes, where it's physical contact or that emotional recognition that there's another person present. And that is actually the essence of life. 1 John chapter 4 talks about recognizing God in others. And it's this good in others and this ability to love and be loved that is present in the dependent person over against the autonomous ideal of the independent, solitary person. And I think just leaving room from the idea of handicap, it's really important to focus on the challenge that handicap brings to our society. By a utilitarian definition, then, handicapped persons might fail in many ways. They don't contribute in this economic way that others might. However, in terms of this idea of dependence and autonomy and the worth of human life, I believe society requires the challenge of handicap to help us realize what human life and responsible life should be about and can be about. Let's read this quote from Jung, who has a handicapped child herself. Our ideals of what perfect human beings are false and mixed up. They are utilitarian and success-orientated. If we can let the handicapped challenge our values, something truly creative can happen. What we instinctively wanted to remove or deny, the handicap, becomes the very thing which brings change, new life. The key is establishing a reciprocal relationship with the handicapped, giving and receiving love at a very basic level sometimes. Nevertheless, it's there. There's a person present. How does this help us think about assisted suicide? Well, there's the logo there from Campaign for Dignity in Dying. They are the pressure group that is promoting a change in the law for assisted dying. And one of their arguments is that dependence is dehumanizing. Dependence on others is dehumanizing. And that it can be regarded as sufficient grounds for suicide. What I'm arguing is the opposite to that, that actually dependence is perfectly natural. And you could even argue that dependence is part of what being a human really is. It's about being able to give and receive love. Certain forms of dependence, so Bigger says, are perfectly natural to human creatures, and learning to live with them and in them is part of growing into human maturity. Isn't that a lovely thought? It means we're not alone, we're part of a community. So, in terms of responsible life and dependence, I would say that it's unnecessary to accept that dependence relegates individuals to biological life not worth living. And that actually human flourishing is far more than simple autonomy, which has been given too much of a prominence in modern society, in my view. And if you look at the essence of Christian character, particularly from the New Testament, character is forged through dependence. Passive virtues grow through dependence. Things like meekness and humility, patience and peace are forged through dependence and is essential to the Christian notion of dignity even. So where do we get to with this? We get to a place where there is quite a solid idea of a non-autonomous responsive life. That there are forms of responsible life that can be led by somebody who actually is quite incapacitated. And it goes beyond the giving and receiving of love. That's the one I focused on, but it could be other forms such as the appreciation of others, the appreciation of God, the appreciation of life going on around you, and bearing witness to the reality of the God that you know. So biographical life, do you remember we're making this distinction between biological life, which is a brute existence where there's no person present, and biographical life where there is a person present. If we now come back to this idea of biographical life, can you see with me that actually there's a much wider scope to what biographical life might be than what many might appreciate? It can be quite passive, it can be quite non-autonomous, it can be quite dependent. It is nevertheless responsible, responsive life where there is a person present. And Bigger once again says something very useful. He says this: we reject a utilitarian notion of social contribution that thinks only in terms of material, quantitative, measurable goods. And we expand the notion of worthwhile service to include acts of sheer and prophetic appreciation of what is good and what is beautiful. In my experience, people with severe dementia can still appreciate a held hand, can still appreciate the recitation of the Lord's Prayer that they would know even in the midst of their dementia. And still appreciate food that they enjoy. So that, remember, we had these two overarching questions. This, can human life lose its value? We've dealt with what is a responsible life. Let's now move on to the tricky area of how is suffering to be viewed? If we have a responsible life and suffering becomes part of it, how do we view what suffering does to that life? Well, those that promote assisted dying would make the point that they feel that suffering in and of itself is only worth bearing if it's compatible with biographical life. If you explore that issue, then two questions come out from that. The first one is, well, if suffering is only worthwhile sometimes, does that mean that sometimes it's pointless? The converse of that, is suffering sometimes purposeful? Is there an intrinsic redemptive purpose to suffering? And secondly, can suffering in and of itself ever reduce biological life to a point where it might be regarded as worthless? Okay. One of the things that might be a challenge to our faith in this situation is something called theodicy, which really is trying to answer the question, why does suffering happen to good people if there is a good God? And somebody might come to the conclusion that, well, actually, suffering can be pointless sometimes. And that's often allied to the idea of, well, if suffering does happen, then again, God can't be that good. There are three good arguments against this. The first one, and this is a couple of big words, eschatological omnipotence. I'll translate that for you, okay? Eschatology is the study of the end times, of what is yet to come. And omnipotence is all-powerfulness. So what that really means is that if things aren't all right now, they will be in the end. Okay? I see Mark smiling. There's a wonderful quote from the Exotic Marigold Hotel, which I only wish this quote was in the Bible. And it goes something along the lines of, it'll be all right in the end, and if it's not all right, it's not the end. The best is yet to be, indeed. So that first argument against theodicy is that God will make things all right in the end. The second argument is this, that we are not robots. There genuinely is real choice in this world. And if there is real choice and free will, then there is the possibility of choosing evil. Therefore, there is evil. Okay? So that means that life in the midst of suffering gives humanity the possibility of choosing to either align yourself with good or align yourself with not good. So there's a real choice to life in the midst of suffering. The third argument, which is a difficult argument and probably doesn't make sense to those that don't have a faith, but to those that do and have lived through suffering, it makes perfect sense. Redemptive suffering allows the testing of faith. Just think of Job. How do you know your faith is genuine unless it's tested? Therefore, suffering is not pointless. So that's the first area in terms of suffering. The second area, coming back to virtue ethics a little bit, is this idea of virtuous personhood. Part of the idea of the Christian faith is that we become disciples. And becoming a disciple means that you are joining in on a pilgrimage that involves character change, involves you changing as a person. And most of us that have walked that road can think back and think, well, yes, there has been change. I would go so far as saying that it's a primary moral duty of human beings, especially those of faith, to take care that your soul is well formed. To take care that this virtuous personhood develops. And it's intrinsically valuable when it does develop. The second thing is then, well, gratefulness for existence is part of this virtuous personhood, because it means that we've got the ability to bear witness to what is good through experiencing bad. And like we've already thought, free will is necessary for all this. And ultimately, we learn through suffering. So suffering is not pointless. It is part and parcel of the development of virtuous personhood. Romans chapter 5 talks about perseverance. Perseverance through what? Through suffering, so that Christian character develops. Those who promote assisted dying might make the point, well, what about unremitting suffering? What about suffering with no end in sight, where it affects the possibility of meaningful vocation? Well, Augustine, who was a 4th century theologian, said this: God had one son on earth without sin, but never one without suffering. And I'd like to ask you this question: how can anyone be sure that God has no further role for them? And part of this living life in the midst of suffering is, in part, the imitation of Christ. Next slide, please. That's the title of an exceptionally good book written 500 years ago. Somebody called Thomas A. Kempis wrote a book called The Imitation of Christ. If you've not read it, do. It's really good. And it dwells on all sorts of things, and one of those things it dwells on is this idea of human suffering as redemptive. That just as Christ is compassionate and forgiving in the midst of his suffering, so we can be compassionate and forgiving to those around us, to the world that has done us this injury. That's an imitation of Christ. It really is small, isn't it? Okay, I'll do my best. You're clever. I've got a screen up there, you see, it's a lot smaller. Enduring suffering as an act of love or justice. This is a very important point. In fact, I will read it off the screen because I can read it better. This is a very, very important point in my view. If there is good reason to suppose that the legalization of voluntary euthanasia might render patients more vulnerable to careless or malevolent pressure to end their lives and undermine society's general affirmation of the exceptional value of the lives of human individuals and its concomitant commitment to support them in adversity, and if patient demand would encourage such legalization, then, listen to this bit, a patient's choice simply to endure suffering rather than ask to be killed could be an act of love and even of justice. What are the concepts in here? They're the concepts of protecting the vulnerable, the concept of preventing the undermining of values, and most importantly for society, promoting support in adversity. Next slide, please. Now, I know these are difficult areas. So we've thought about what is a responsible life, and it's much broader than we might have thought, perhaps. We've thought about how suffering is to be viewed, and it can be viewed as essential to the Christian life even, and certainly redemptive. That still leaves the question, when might bodily life, brute existence, be deemed valueless? Well, the conclusion we've come to, I think, is that it cannot very easily lose its value. A life not worth living is very, 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 very rare. Responsible life has a very broad definition. It can be a passive, responsive existence when a person is present in a very basic form. Even with a disintegrated personality, you can still have the capacity to give and receive love, and that's the essence of life. However, I think I might concede just this. It is possible that human life can lose its value if that life is permanently incapable of biographical life at all and of any form of service, because then suffering is just non-redemptive and vocation is inconceivable. And what I'm really saying is that there's no longer a person at home. There is brute existence but no personhood. And that might be very rare circumstances such as permanent vegetative state, okay, where there is no brain function in the higher functions. To give you some idea of how rare this is, there are 64.1 million people in the United Kingdom and perhaps 1,000 people in the whole of the country who are in such a vegetative state. So very rare. Okay. Is everybody all right? Okay. Do you want to stretch your legs or do you want to carry on? Carry on. Okay. I realize this is a very serious topic and it can be emotionally demanding just thinking through it and sitting through it, so I appreciate that. So let's move on to the next bit then. So we've looked at the question is it possible for human life to lose its value? And we're basically saying, well, no, it's not, apart from very, very, very rare circumstances where there's no person present. But where there is a potential person present, then life does not lose its value. That then leads us on to the second question, which is it ever permissible to kill an innocent person? Traditional Christian orthodoxy would say that killing is prohibited, but you're permitted to let people die. There are challenges to this from those that would promote assisted dying around suggestions of moral equivalence between letting die and killing, equivalent effects, and even raising the question that killing innocents does not necessarily mean to be intrinsically bad. I'm going to look at each of those individually. First of all, moral equivalence. What an advocate of assisted dying might argue is this, that we are equally responsible for acts of omission and acts of commission, what we do and what we don't do. And that because of that equal responsibility, then our moral intent, our intention, is morally equivalent. So therefore, by killing somebody and by not doing anything for somebody such that they die, they would argue that's morally equivalent and not intrinsically different. Okay? That's a consequentialist ethic. Remember those things I showed you at the beginning? The outcome is the same, therefore the morals are the same in the view of consequentialists. However, I would say that there are reasons for preferring letting die over killing. First of all, the idea of non-maleficence. That means first doing no harm to somebody. And secondly, this is ignoring the availability of good palliative care. Letting somebody die does not mean not caring for them. There is good palliative care that can care for somebody whilst they slip from this earth. This palliative care context, just stating it clearly, is not morally equivalent to active killing. It involves the admirable choice to cease futile treatment. You know, if you know that treatment will make no difference to somebody's end result, stop the treatment that's futile. And you then enter a palliative situation where you do your best to control the symptoms and you make life as comfortable as possible and you make death as good as possible. I've spent 3 years working in a hospice and I can say without reservation that in my 20 years in medical practice, the best nurses I've ever worked with were the nurses at Hayward House. So, coming back to our argument, if you then try and claim that there is moral equivalence between killing somebody and letting them die, when you know there's effective palliative care available, then choosing to kill is a morally culpable act of impatience, where you're trying to get quickly to the same end without really availing yourself of all the care and compassion that's available. Something that's significant to palliative care is something called the doctrine of double effect. Thomas Aquinas was a 13th century theologian who first established this doctrine. And the doctrine effectively says this. You can have one act with two outcomes. One of those outcomes is intended, and that's the thing you're aiming at. And intention is absolutely key here. That's the thing you're aiming at. That same single act might have a second, unwanted, but accepted outcome. Okay. For example, if somebody is in severe pain, you give them a risky dose of painkiller. You know it's risky, the patient knows it's risky, but it's not so risky that it's definitely lethal, but it's still risky. With informed consent, you then give that dose of painkiller. The intention and the aim is to relieve the pain. You don't know that it won't do something that shortens their life. You hope it doesn't. You're not aiming at that. You never aim for that. But that might be the unwanted, unintended outcome. That is morally different to intending to kill, where you give an obvious lethal dose. Do you see what I mean? And to illustrate it with a more down-to-earth example, the doctrine of double effect is pretty much used every day in every medical decision. If you go for an operation, you have informed consent. Now, I hope nobody's about to have an operation here, because what I'm about to tell you is not a secret, but it's not something everybody notices, is that there is a risk of death with every operation. Even the most simple operation, if you have a general anesthetic, there is a small but real risk of death. That's an unwanted, unintended, not aimed for outcome. But in going for that procedure, you accept that it might happen. Do you see what I mean? Okay. So next slide, please. So, one of the arguments that those that argue for assisted dying make is this, that there are equivalent effects to letting die and killing, and that the moral significance lies solely in the effects. And what they're doing is effectively removing this doctrine of double effect and saying, well, you know, we don't think that way. It doesn't matter. They claim there is no difference between giving a risky painkiller dose and an obvious lethal injection, when one might be 100 milligrams and the other might be 2,000 milligrams. Do you see what I mean? So, first of all, I would challenge this idea that the effects are equivalent. And secondly, there is a deep problem within the idea of consequentialism. This is this second area of ethics that tends to be used. It is very difficult to foresee every consequence. And consequentialism falls foul of overlooking consequences. And I would suggest this consequence to be one that is overlooked. That if you intend to kill, even though that person might eventually be close to death and die soon anyway, that intention to kill is in and of itself a consequence, because there's an effect to that. There's a potential corruption of moral character. Because when you intend to kill somebody, the agent that kills identifies with that morality and increases future inclinations to kill after that event. So there's a potential corruption of moral character. And I would say, therefore, that identical outcome, i.e. the patient dies in both situations, is not tantamount to moral indistinguishability. You can distinguish between the two courses of action. The third area, just to briefly consider, is killing innocents intrinsically bad? Consequentialism, which is the prominent ethical theory used in health services, challenges the notion of intrinsically bad acts. In consequentialism, there is no such thing as intrinsically good and intrinsically bad. There's no right way and wrong way. It's just, what are the outcomes? And consequentialists have problems with rules. The reason they have problems with rules is that the best overall foreseen outcome may not be allowable, such as killing the patient. And as we've already highlighted, there's a flaw to this ethical theory. The flaw is that you have problems foreseeing every outcome. So we have to be very careful about what ethical theory we choose. And as you can probably get feeling from me, I have my doubts about consequentialism as a way of deciding about end-of-life decision-making, really. However, there is one point that they make which I think is worth pausing and thinking about, and this is the idea of the principle of innocence. If we say that no innocent person can ever be killed as a result of an act, then that would actually prevent a lot of risk-taking medical intervention, because then actually anything that might kill somebody you couldn't do otherwise. Whereas part of the doctrine of double effects says that accepted deaths as part of the risk of a procedure is morally acceptable. Do you see where I'm going with that? Yeah. So what that means is that there is room, there is ethical room for the death of an innocent. But intention is the key. And Thomas Aquinas makes this point very clearly. He makes the case by looking at if somebody attacks you in self-defense, then your intention is to protect yourself. And if you kill the person attacking you, then that's a death besides the intention of the act. And the point to this is that intentional killing is ruled out because it ensures the common good and it avoids expression of malevolence towards innocent persons. But what it does do is it leaves ethical room for death besides the intention. You're aiming to help somebody. You're not aiming to kill them, but they might die even though you're aiming to do something else. Okay. So what does this boil down to? I think it boils down to this, really. Intention is key to understanding this, and intending death or not is key to making the ethical decision. Intending shapes your character, it shapes who you are, and it shapes society around you. And in my view, intending death corrupts character. So, given that there is ethical room for innocent death sometimes, what about returning to our example of the life where the personhood is absent? When personhood is absent such that the only thing that's present is breathing and beating heart, there is no brain function, no personality, no communication, then that reveals what could be called the instrumentality of biological life. Okay? Biological life is not the same as personhood. We've already established that. Instrumentality is revealed when somebody is so damaged, like persistent vegetative state, that there is no person present. Now, Bigger does make this tentative suggestion. Human life does not continue to have an intrinsic value when, through severe brain damage, it lacks irremediably the power to enable other forms of human flourishing, such as friendship. Okay? There's no person present. There's an absence of personhood. And when bodily life has become permanently incapable of sustaining the capacity for responsible life, it would be proportionate to choose to end that life. That's biological life. It's not personhood. Very rare circumstances. So, given our journey so far, given the fact that there is room ethically for the death of an innocent, given the fact that we've made this distinction between biographical and biological, a case can be made, I think, for non-voluntary euthanasia, for somebody whose biological life cannot sustain responsible life. So somebody where the person is now absent, it has to be non-voluntary euthanasia under those circumstances because there's no person there to make the choice. So you're making the decision for them based upon what you think their wishes might have been. What about Aquinas' thinking? Well, Aquinas' rule doesn't apply here because there's no lethal harm to a responsible member of society because there isn't a person present. And intending to kill is not an expression of hostility to that person. It's a preference aimed at whole community fulfillment. So there is possibly, I think, a case for non-voluntary euthanasia for those where persons are no longer present. That is not what the Marist Bill is about. The Marist Bill is about capable persons who are competent and present, who have a biographical life, wanting to choose to terminate their own lives through assisted suicide. In my view, having gone through everything we've discussed, there is no case for voluntary euthanasia, and there is no case for assisted suicide, because we've looked at responsible life and what it is, and we've looked at sort of whether it's ever right to kill an innocent, responsible person. And we've answered both those questions. So we've come to the place where no, euthanasia is not morally permissible from a Christian perspective, and assisted suicide is not morally permissible from a Christian perspective. In the very, very rare circumstances of absent personhood, then a case for non-voluntary euthanasia can be made. However, Can does not mean should. Okay? I'm trying to present a balanced argument here. I hope you can hear the way I've wrestled with this. This next bit is really important. There's something called the slippery slope. Some of you may have heard of it. Where if you legalize something for one group, there can be creep in medical and legal practice to another group that it was never intended to apply to. And it could creep into vulnerable groups. This has already happened in British legal history. The best modern example is that of the Abortion Act. In 1967, the Abortion Act was passed with a view to stopping backstreet abortions and ending the deaths of mothers who were having illegal terminations. There's been moral creep such that today, I think it's fair to say that there is abortion on demand. People can have abortion whenever they wish it. That's not the intention of the original legislation. So, what that means is there can be long-term social effects that are unknown and unmeasurable from any legal change of this nature. And I want to have two pauses for thought here. You know, first of all, just to say the Maris Bill suggests voluntary euthanasia and assisted suicide. That is not something that we've managed to establish a case for. Secondly, it does not touch on non-voluntary euthanasia, but if it did, and we said, okay, there's a case for that, let's legalize it, that's not necessarily a sensible thing to do for two reasons. First of all, if you then enable professionals and institutions to carry out the killing of human biological life, that has consequences that can lead to moral creep. It could then move to other vulnerable groups. It might alter the professional and institutional character. We've focused a lot on the virtue and ethics. We've focused a lot on the nature of the person and how your intentions form who you are. Bigger says this: it does not follow that medical practice should admit these exceptions, such as killing somebody in a persistent vegetative state, unless a negative answer can be given to the question, would doctors who are the moral agents in these exceptional acts of killing the dying be corrupted by them, and medicine's impulse to save be weakened? So it's about character, it's about impulse to save. Secondly, and this is a second pause for thought, we've talked about the creep of legislation in abortion from very restricted circumstances to no abortion available on demand. Similarly, if an institutional right to die was legalized for a small and defined group of people, there might be unforeseen, unknowable creep such that it would move into vulnerable persons. So an institutional right to die could become a duty to die. For example, imagine somebody who is incapacitated might regard themselves as a burden on their family and society around them. If there is legally available the right to die, then that person might feel a moral duty to end their life because they feel they are a burden on others, even though they do not wish to end their life. Secondly, it does require the acceptance of the notion of a life not worthy to be lived. And I think that's dangerous for all the sorts of things we've already talked about. Is there such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived? And we've looked at biographical responsible life, and we've seen that non-responsive, very basic forms of life are worthy to be lived. It's about giving and receiving love. And thirdly, it affects society's attitude to non-rehabilitable illness. If we start to think differently about the worth of life, where does that end? So, and we're coming into land now, could does not mean should. So we've pretty much made the case that there isn't a case for voluntary euthanasia, there isn't a case for assisted suicide. In a small group of very rare circumstances, there might be a case, but even if there might be a case, the could does not mean should. That there is a preciousness to life, and there is a resolve to help in society that we should be careful not to erode. And my view, I think, is that the answer to difficulties at the end of life is not assisted dying, it's better palliative care. And if we're going to put our money in somewhere, let's research better palliative care. Let's invest in those excellent nurses that work in Hayward House. Let's invest in those nursing homes that provide specialist dementia care. Intentional killing, in such cases, could be permissible. Whether it actually should be permissible in a medical context depends on the denouement of one further consideration. Can intentional killing of patients by themselves or by doctors be permitted without undermining a humane society's general commitment to the preciousness of human life and without undermining the ordinary resolve of its members to support each other in adversity? Next slide. So, the last slide. My conclusion is this. Regarding the Maris Bill on the 11th of September, because of the corrupting effects of permitting the killing of innocents on professional and institutional character, and the risk that society or medicine's impulse to save may be compromised, such moral permission should not be translated into an institutional right to die. Therefore, in my view, Christians should oppose the Maris Bill. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it's been a difficult topic and an emotive one, and I hope I've been able to help you think some of this through. Thank you. Can I just take this opportunity to thank all the people that helped this evening as well. Thanks, Robin, for doing the slides. Really important. Barry for the sound, and Sue and Debbie for the coffee. There is an opportunity. This is not a debate, so I'm not up for sort of having a big argument, but I think it's important to be able to talk about these things. If anybody has any questions, then now's the time to ask them. Would anybody like to ask anything? It's Richard, isn't it? Yeah. Do you want to borrow
the mic? I was just going to say it's very difficult for an outsider, even a doctor, to decide what's going on inside another person's mind, even if they're sedated or, you know, under some medical treatment. It's very difficult to decide.
It is, absolutely, which is why, if you remember, we looked at sort of the idea of the hidden person, with the locked-in syndrome. You can still communicate, the Stephen Hawking kind of situation, where you can find ways to the hidden person. And the dormant person, somebody who is in a coma, but possibly reversible, and they might come out of that coma, and who knows what's going on in there. And which is why I protected those areas from even thinking about the possibility of ending a life. The only thing that I raised the question on is where, as far as we can know, and I agree, it is as far as we can know, for persistent vegetative state and conditions like that, where if you do brain scans, there is no activity in the brain at all for the higher cerebral functions. So thinking is just not there. The only thing that's happening is what's called reflex actions, where the body on its own, without any person being present, can breathe and can have a heart beating and so on. But I agree, you know, it's dangerous to mind read, isn't it? Roxy? Yeah?
Could you clarify the options for persistent vegetative state? If we've got reservations about euthanasia, but so they're breathing and heart beating on their own, but presumably reliant on artificial food and fluids, is one option to withdraw that?
Absolutely, yeah, we didn't really sort of expand the various options there, but persistent vegetative state, which is that one very rare circumstance I mentioned where, for all intents and purposes, a person is no longer present. Because they are, that the machine of the body is still working, so the body is still breathing, the body is still has beating heart, clearly the person cannot eat, swallow, drink. So in order for that person to continue living, you need to provide food and fluid. We're getting into sort of more, it's really a different discussion there about how do you help somebody in those circumstances, because if you withdraw care, then sort of two things can happen. Either somebody can carry on biologically living for a while, and that's very difficult for everybody concerned, or they can deteriorate and die. And that's really a different ethical situation. It's not about sort of, you know, it's tricky, isn't it? Which is why you asked the question. It's very rare, and I suppose we have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, if you withdraw life support and somebody carries on living for a while, then it's very difficult for all concerned, isn't it? Yeah. And was there a question down here? Somebody started saying something. No. Sheila.
First of all, thank you for giving a measured presentation of your views. Which I cannot accept. and that's a problem, isn't it? I cannot see society providing adequate facilities, encouragement, etc., to make palliative care universally available. I just don't think the money will be there. Simple as that.
That's a very good point, isn't it? And I think what you have to think about is, you know, if we are making end-of-life decisions for economic reasons, then we have to be clear that we're making end-of-life decisions about economic reasons. What we can't do is make an ethical dance about it and say, well, let's justify ending life for some other reason. If society cannot afford palliative care, then society can't afford palliative care. But if, like most of the world, but if we're going to put our money somewhere, I would rather put the money in palliative care rather than in services to terminate lives. That's what I'm arguing. And I think that palliative care services are very good where they exist and could be better. And I think at least some of it is about medical education, that you could improve the palliative capacity of general medical services. You could train physicians and oncologists and geriatricians and GPs. Yes, good point. My wife, Debbie, is GP. A lot of palliative care is done by general practitioners. So, and that's my background. You know, I did general practice and palliative care. And education and, releasing the capacity and the potential within the services we already have, I think personally is the way forward. And I agree that there are economic consequences to that, but I don't think we should pretend through an ethical argument that it's okay to do something. And if you want to make an economic decision, make an economic decision. If you really want to make an economic decision, the vast majority of healthcare on an individual person's life is spent on the last year of life. So if you can identify beforehand when somebody's going to die, pop them off a year before, you save a lot of money. But that isn't ethical in my view. Lots of hands. I'm not sure whose was first. Is it Nikki? Or Nikki and then yourself? Yeah.
Really, are you conflating the existence of the soul with the biographical life rather than with the biological life?
I guess, yes, I am. It's about personhood, and there's all sorts of questions here about whether you think there's a dualistic or a tripartite sort of human being or not, but I think that personally feel there is a difference between biological human material and the presence or absence of a soul. That stands to reason. You can take a bit of my skin off and grow it in a petri dish. My soul is not in the petri dish, but biological human material is there. But you've touched upon a very pertinent point, which is this, and hence the seriousness of this discussion. Effectively, what we're deciding is, has a soul departed? And thankfully, we've come to the conclusion that actually we don't need to send a soul off early. But you're right, I was being brave and saying, well, I think in persistent vegetative state, in my view, the soul has gone. Yeah. I think this gentleman was next. Yeah.
Assisted dying has been present illegal in Oregon for 20 years and in Holland and Belgium for about 10 years. An unexpected consequence of assisted dying in Belgium and Holland was an improvement of palliative care. And so there must be evidence of sort of moving down a slippery slope from Oregon and Belgium.
Very good question. Holland's a very interesting case. It's only been legal for assisted dying to be carried out in Holland since 2002, but actually it's been practiced since 1980. They just didn't prosecute anybody. And there are all sorts of things happening in terms of when you research, it depends on what population you sample, it depends on who you survey, it depends on whether what kind of questions you ask, whether they're quantitative questions, whether they're qualitative questions that actually dig to what's underneath it all. What we certainly know from Oregon is that 59% of those who have availed themselves of assisted dying, one of their major reasons was because they felt a burden to others. If that's the reason somebody's terminating their life, then I don't care how much you say, well, palliative care services has improved. If people are ending their lives because they feel a burden, then there's something wrong there. There is some evidence that the confidence of elderly Dutch people going into hospital in terms of how safe they feel going into hospital has been eroded, and many are now choosing to go over the border to Germany. As with any statistics, you can really create what you want if you're creative enough. I think I would not make an ethical argument on the basis of empirical statistics any day. I would do it on the basis of ethical argument, but I appreciate your question. Yeah. Lots of hands.
I wonder whether it would probably take another evening, but to widen the discussion of withholding treatment, given that we are in a society that is getting older and older, and we're in one that is not currently affording the marvellous NHS that we have. We're not spending the same as even our European counterparts. So we've got a big problem. And to take an example, those who are over 80 do incredibly badly in intensive care, and it's very expensive, compared to those who are much younger. Are we going to have to sort of widen the debate and consider that withholding treatment might be making a rational, difficult decision to not admit someone that has poor quality of life? And hear me, you know, I'm not a big believer in chronological age, but to withhold treatment by not sending someone to a very expensive place where they're not likely to do well.
Very sensible, well-made points, and I think I agree. I think one of the things that I mentioned at the beginning was one of the drivers for all this is technological developments that has extended the process of dying. The biblical view of dying is it's part of life. We're all going to die, and it's about having a good death, and the ideal death would be with our family around us, gradually, comfortably slipping away, isn't it? Intensive care is the exact opposite of that in many cases. And so if you technologically make death something different, then you have to question what are we doing there, really. And this is about society having to decide, actually, where do we want to put the scarce resources we have in an ethical way that is humane, still remains a caring society that sits with people and holds their hand through adversity, but doesn't make the shortcut of saying, well, you're too expensive, let's just press the button. And I think it's an important thing to talk about. Probably requires a whole other evening, really, doesn't it? It wasn't quite at the centre of what we were talking about, but it's so important, isn't it? Yeah. You've already had a go, Richard. Oh, there you go.
Can I ask whether the Murray's Bill makes provision for doctors to opt out? Because if we're looking at the ethics from the patient's point of view, surely it's morally reprehensible to oblige doctors to kill when it's against their... Yeah.
Yes. I've got a copy of the bill here if anybody wants to see it. The flip side of it is easily accessible online. You just go to... Well, you can go to the Care Not Killing website or No Do Assisted Suicide websites, and you can access the bill there. What the bill states is that you can, conscientiously opt out. So as a doctor, just as a doctor is not obliged to be involved in abortions if they feel they object to the idea, then you do not have to be involved with assisted dying. Two doctors are required, according to this bill. One who knows the patient and another who sort of, that sort of thing. However, these are sort of legal sort of points to the bill. the discussion this evening was less about the legalities and more about the ethics of actually should the bill even be written in the first place, let alone what's in it. But yes, should this become law, then doctors with a conscientious objection are not obliged to take part in this, as is the case with abortion.
My background's in mental health, and I assume that people who want to end their lives because of psychological suffering, and many people will say that they can cope better with physical suffering than the mental pain of psychiatric illness. Would you like to make a comment about that, and also in connection with what the bill is actually going to say about people with psychological who are in psychological suffering?
The bill does mention depression and a psychological assessment. There's one paragraph on there where some form of psychological assessment is made, and somebody has to be sort of deemed sort of stable enough to make the decision that they want to end their lives. And there is a nod towards depression, but people can suffer depression in all sorts of circumstances. If you were facing the final exit, it would affect your mood somewhat. And so I think this is a very grey and difficult area. I think also, if you look at evidence from other European countries, this is exactly the sort of creep that could happen that is quite dangerous should this bill become law. There have been cases in other European countries of people availing themselves of assisted dying purely because of being in a depressed state. And that's very worrying. And there's some talk, I think in Belgium, if I'm right, of allowing people under the age of 18 who are suffering with depression to also consider such acts. I think. Is that right? Terry might know a bit better. Have you heard something?
The Belgian Senate voted in 2012 to allow children to be included in assisted suicide.
Thank you, Terry. Can I? Oh, no, this is my wife. I better give her it first.
I think one of the most important things for me about something like this evening is thinking. Even if you think differently, I don't mind that as much as if you don't think at all. And so I had a really interesting conversation with a doctor that I'm training about an event that they'd been involved in. And they had gone along with the prevailing attitude and at the time in a situation that they were in, and they didn't think about it then, and they didn't think about it for another 5 or 10 years, and then they did think about it, and then they thought very differently about it, and there was a lot of distress and anguish from it. And of course people change, of course you have to accept that people change and develop different views, and I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that if you just, and there is a temptation because it sounds ridiculous to say, but people are busy and life is life and things are happening and you choose things and you do things because it's just what you choose and what you do. But what we often don't do before we act is think. And that's a bit, I think, that I'm encouraged about. And I think there is something to me about medical education challenging people to think at a very early stage, before they are in a point where they are pressured or expected or assuming is sometimes as difficult, that they will do things. And because they haven't thought it through, it's tempting to go along with it because it's just what everybody else is doing. And that, I think, is dangerous. So I think thinking is underrated and underdone.
I guess this is very much the point this evening. We may or may not all agree on everything I've been presenting, but we're all thinking, and that's really important. Yeah. Thank
you. Many, many years ago, I was at a meeting, a medical meeting. I'm a doctor and a neurologist. And the Archbishop of York was present at the meeting. The meeting was held in Durham. And after he'd said his piece, I went up to him and asked him a question. And I was very grateful to the lady at the back who introduced the subject of the soul, because that was my question to the Archbishop. I said to the Archbishop, in the case of advanced dementia, where is the soul? Which sort of links up with what you've been saying. And his answer was very interesting. Incidentally, he was your namesake. A relation?
No, mine's with a P, he's got a B.
Yeah. Well, now, he said, what is the soul, he said. The soul is the connection between the Almighty and the individual. It's nothing else. And it's always there. No matter how advanced the dementia, how bad the persistent vegetative state, it is still there. I think that answers most of the question.
That would be the Archbishop of York's view. His name is nearly the same as mine. In fact, I got married in his diocese, and when I rang up and said, "Is Dr. Hapgood on the phone?" it was quite an interesting effect on the other end of the phone, actually. There are many different ways of thinking about the soul, and that is absolutely a different discussion. It's about ensoulment. When does the soul enter the human body? When does the soul leave the human body? Goodness me, it's tricky, isn't it? My view is that when a person is no longer present, then the person is somehow wrapped up with the soul, and therefore the person isn't there. But that's a risky theological statement to make, because it then removes the soul from embodiment, and you can't do that very easily. So, it's a tricky one, and that's a different evening. Yeah, I can see some thoughtful hands to the chin there. Yeah.
Just to comment on that, we do believe in bodily resurrection, so body is obviously important along the whole thing, the whole debate. Just thank you for tonight. We don't talk about death. My wife works for Crewe's Bereavement Care, and it's astounding how many married couples, and I may be talking to people here, who've never talked that one of them might go before the other. And that is a big thing. And I'm just very glad that the congregation that I have some links with is having a plan to have a group discussion about death, which you've enabled tonight, and I hope will go on. Because my question would be, how do we help Christians? I'm a pastor, and so I've been to many, bedsides and hospital, the rest of it, and death, and coping with bereavement. But it would be a lot easier if we talked about death, how we understand it, and open the Bible. There's a lot about death in the Bible, and how we handle it. And I've just been asked to lead some Bible studies on it, so I've got to go and do my homework. But it does make a big difference, because it's sad that a bill in Parliament has at last got Christians talking about death. And my question is, how can we do more talking about death? Because I honestly believe we're the only people in the world who have something positive to say. The best is yet to be was the Reverend John Wesley, a good Anglican and who became a Methodist.
Thank you, Andrew. That's a really good point, one full of hope to end the evening on, perhaps, if there are no more hands shooting upwards. We're nearing 9:30 now. Thank you for listening. Thanks for your excellent questions. This topic could overflow into other topics so easily, couldn't it? Thank you also for your patience, those among you who don't share the faith I have. Thank you for being here. I hope you found it helpful. I'd like to end with a prayer, if that's okay. Is that all right? So, Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for this space. Thank you for this time. Thank you that you give us minds to think and communities to belong to, and other people to form our characters. Thank you that you're the giver of life. Thank you, Lord Jesus, that through being obedient to the Father, you have given us eternal life. And thank you, Holy Spirit, through your presence, that we might be continually in communion with our Father in heaven and with each other through the mystery of the Holy Spirit, not only now, but through death and into the life beyond. In Jesus' mighty name, amen. Oh, yeah. Okay. Do you want to say a word or shall I say it? Okay. Right. The way I've tried to present this evening is a balanced discussion. So I've kind of raised the arguments for assisted dying, and I've made the arguments against. The bill is on 11th, is being voted on in the House of Commons on the 11th of September, Friday the 11th of September. If you feel you would like to contact your MP to indicate your views on this matter, then please do so, because this is a free vote and there's no party whips. People, the MPs can vote how they want. It's a vote of conscience, okay? So what you can do at the very least is contact them and say, please be at the vote and vote, because actually, you know, they need to be there. And secondly, if you feel so moved as to perhaps suggest to them that, you know, in your view, they should vote against this bill, that is the conclusion I've come to. There are cards here that can help you contact your MP with that view if you want to make that point. I would hope that you would join me in that, but, you know, the world's a place where we have different views and some of you may not agree with me. But if you do, here are the cards that can help you vote through your MP. Where shall I put them? I'll put them on the table. I'll stand at the back with them, actually, yeah. Okay, thanks very much for being here. Bless you. Safe journeys home. And see you again sometime.